News in French from Jerusalem, past the value of the gold Napoleon in relation to the shekel, Radio Mediterranean amidst in English a flying hospital soon to be put into service in Italy, carried by regular plane, the voice of America, Tamil insurrections in Sri Lanka, a concert of Baroque music held in Aspen, Colorado tent, sip chai and codis, this is Gemischluck, twirl the buttons, tune in the voices, invisible waves surround and pierce as Jack and Jean are our Hades, and not just news from it, condemn the servile policy of European bourgeois states in front of US aggression, fade out from communist, not yet state-of-the-art technology, who rules these waves? Wind came up, waves on the beach and in the air, changed Poland into an Arab pop song. World War III will be declared in English. A live voice, it must be true. I heard it on the shortwave grapevine tonight. There is an energy conference somewhere else. Neo-colonialist division of labor. The Congolese people discuss the new five-year plan to overcome colonialist static. Wanted to hear Herodotus on the radio. But all that was said was, you have just heard, vous venez d'entendre, usted escucho, evening news, nouvelle du soir, nachrichten, always after the fact and detached from the surrounding world, closed upon itself like a hedgehog, a furious mullah breaks in, Louis soit Jésus-Christ, Radio Vatican still meddling 2,000 years later, but the Arab's discourse had the edge, quicker, louder, covers the tire Jesuit for a while, they run parallel, but the Vatican's Frenchman, a trained long-distance runner, they got experience in that area. He come through clean through the caesuras of Arabic rhetoric. The future messenger of good news. Better kill him than the one who only tells the truth about the past, no matter how bad Sapientia Christiana is, theological unity and the problem of forming missionaries, jihad clearer, if not cleaner, at least bad news are called just that. Here the messenger is killed even before he opens his mouth. Inshallah, the Vatican has been displaced, the Arab rhetoric so fierce, though no jihad, only Radio Jordan, listing the names of grateful listeners who had written in to the station from somewhere else, a nursery rhyme, another station comes back to haunt us, greetings and welcome, Gentile talks of Longinus, an empress dowager, 255-330 AD, traveled all over, finds remains of Holy Cross in Colchester or Turkey, Constance married her, then discarded her. One son, Constantine the Great, her life drowned out by local music and imported heritage. Devout and chaste, poetry is dead. Prose is dying. Architecture has lapsed into the horny hands of the engineers. Barbarians from the East contest victory of Christianity. No counterpoint. Oh, voila, inshallah. Dawn, a lone black dog, a beach, a mirror, a shaving bowl, empty batteries led to rickety three-rung ladder, leads to flower sack filled with unknown, looks out over the sea, she rises in its back, catch you later, hours to go, a full frontal, two oars anchored offshore, small, white, shiny black outboard tarpaulin covered net catch, cost 10 mile offshore, no jewels in the haze, short waves fade out, table on a terrace, blue cap, white jacket, part of description included, beyond my eyes, the gesture excludes fullness, not foam enough for Aphrodite, a man on a mule parallels the consequent limit.
Greetings, comrades. You are in tune to WGXC 90.7 FM. This is a Poet Radio program. We began the program today with a track from Pierre Joris's Roots Not Roots 2007 CD. I think it was this.
Something like that.
Track is called A Gian Shortwave, and it features Nicole Parafit on the vocals and some random, maybe radio tracks in the background, right?
Yep.
And my guest on the program today tonight and for here ever after on the archive is my former professor, Pierre Joris, who is in the Hudson Valley this weekend and to commemorate his 50th graduation from Bard College.
Lordy Lord, time sure flies.
We are conversing a couple of hours in advance of Pierre's reading at Bard, and that reading will be recorded and be broadcast later in this program as well. So I know you get up to the Hudson Valley and you come back to Bard every so often, but it must be interesting 50 years on to come back and see your old professors still alive.
Well, there's only one around. That's the poet Robert Kelly,
right?
And who still teaches, you know, who told me once, no student of mine may retire before I do. But then later he told me that he will not retire. So I did retire from teaching. That allows me actually to do more work in terms of writing and translating and editing, etc.
You've accomplished so much. You've done so much work. You've been all over the place. But I was thinking, wow, I wonder what the most significant achievement for Pierre is. I wonder if it's something as simple as surviving.
I wrote very long ago, survival is double death. I.e., if you concentrate on surviving, you're not really able to do anything beyond that. And to me, survival was in a way always a given. You know, as long as I'm here to do things. Survival in a way is easy. I moved countries any number of times. I set up shop elsewhere, you know, you find a place to do. And then simply I could do the work I wanted to do. And I think in a way I was lucky and never, you know, was run over by a truck or anything of that matter, you know,
right.
happened. And so I was able to keep doing the work I wanted to do. And, you know, I see myself as very lucky.
Well, the CD that we started with, I mean, it's a very interesting title, but appropriate for you, right? The Roots, R-O-U-T-E-S, yeah. Not Roots, R-O-O-T-S.
Roots or routes, not roots, yes.
I mean, we all have a certain kind of R-O-O-T roots, mm-hmm. but you're saying, one of the things you're saying is that the roots, the adventure, the journey is one of the things that drives you.
Very much. I'm born in Europe, in the smallest country in Europe. And my grandfather said, you can travel, but you always got to come back here because this is the greatest place in the world. This is paradise. And I never believed him. And my sense was that Europe was very much Maya. Early on, I had an image that European culture and the way it was taught, the way we were brought up in it post-World War II, was the roots, you are stuck. Your legs are your roots, and you are stuck deep in the ground, and you can't get out. You can't move. Mm-hmm. And so when I discovered American literature in Europe, and I found a copy of On the Road, discarded on a beach, you know, in Spain, I realized that, yes, Europe is history, and we are mired in it. America is geography, in a way, and you can move in it. So from early on, I had that image of moving. Of course, you know, the Kerouac image is too simplistic, finally, but I developed my own versions of those in Nomadic Poetics and so on. But America certainly was a major image in that sense, that it was a wide open space that you could move through. Geographically, whereas Europe was mired in history.
I don't think we actually mentioned Luxembourg yet. You said it was the smallest country and it was paradise, but we're talking about Luxembourg.
Well, my grandfather said it was paradise. I call it the belly button of Europe or the lint therein.
I remember a funny story. You have to verify this. Once upon a time, you were with Allen Ginsberg and Jerry Garcia, and they were trying to plan an overthrow of Luxembourg.
That was my insane idea in about 71 probably. Woodstock had happened, the concert. I was living in New York, and in the Dead were doing a concert at the Fillmore East, and I Sodom, and I was interviewing Garcia, and Ginsburg was there. And I told Jerry that Luxembourg would be a place to create a concert, that if that many people came as had come to Woodstock, we would be a majority in the country and we could take over the country, and it had the best media radio station of all of Europe, and we could just, you know, from there conquer Europe for the cause of, you know, rock and roll and
peace and love,
peace and, yeah, and dope and everything, you know. And Jerry was very enthusiastic about it. He said, wow, that's kind of, how could we, you know. And then Ginsburg interfered and got very sternly ethical and said, but Pierre, there are people living there. You cannot take over from them. And so that deflated Garcia's and my balloon of
revolution.
The revolutionary takeover of Luxembourg.
I'm glad you mentioned the media and radio there, because this is one of the things you and I have had in common as younger men, as we both did radio, and we're still doing radio this very day. But you were with Radio France and did some
France Culture.
Culture. And you were inspiring to me because you used to tell the stories of walking around with your Nagra recorder,
yeah,
and
like 25 pounds on the shoulder,
like, all to for the greater good for radio.
Yeah, I loved that medium a lot. I was never very image pitched, so TV in a way never interested me. Film, weirdly enough, both my kids are film people, are in film.
That's right.
But I was with radio. I liked the voice. I think it came from poetry and from the fact that I learned so much from poetry by listening to, going to readings, listening to it. The first critic of my work, Paul Blackburn, the way when I gave him poems, what he would do, he would not tell me what was wrong or right with them. He would say, come and listen to this. And he would put on a tape on his old, you know, tape deck, and make me listen to someone until I understood what he meant and what that had to do with my work.
Wow, that's an anecdote that I hadn't heard. That's very, very interesting.
It was.
You're lucky to have known Paul Blackburn. He's another original recorder type.
That's right. I mean, my apprenticeship, when after I graduated from Bard, Robert Kelly gave me two phone numbers. One was Paul Blackburn, one was Jerry Rothenberg. And I moved to New York, and Jerry was always good, he and Diane, for some chicken and some food. And Paul was always good for some Spanish brandy. So I was, it was very lucky and a wonderful way to be initiated. And so I began, you know, I showed them, Paul specifically, my work, because we both lived on 7th Street at that moment in the East Village.
So you mentioned Jerome Rothenberg, and this is another person you've had a long, long-term engagement with, and it's been, what, 25 years since you two edited those amazing anthologies?
Well, it was in the 90s. I mean, you know, we've known each other just since 69, and in the 80s, even in the 70s, Jerry would often come to London when I was living there. And in the early 80s, we meet there, or I would come to America, and we decided to do some work together. And we started out by translating Kurt Schwitters. Then we did the selected poems of Pablo Picasso, the man totally unknown for his poetry and who wanted to have written on his grave, "Here lies Pablo Ruiz Picasso, poet who also dabbled in paint." Right, but
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yes, so we did those two books, and Jerry had, of course, the master of the anthology of the 20th century avant-garde anthology, had already done 3 or 4. And I always had an idea, because his book that he did with our friend George Kwasha called America, Prophecy, and Prophecy kind of irritated me because I thought it was too religious a term.
And it comes from Blake, though, right?
I know. But I always thought a vision. And so I went Blake in and I said, I want to do an anthology called Europe, a Vision. And then Jerry and I, talking about this, said, came up with the idea, well, why not do a world anthology of the avant-garde? And so I came back, moved back to America in 87, and it was with Jerry's help. He was at Binghamton at that time. And we started working on Poems for the Millennium. Yeah. We did the first two volumes over the next 10 years.
I was happy to start the program with your CD, the Roots Not Roots CD, as previously mentioned. And I was, as we were in touch getting ready for this, I wanted to, I told you I was going to start with an old recording of I had made of you. It's a poem for Eric Mottram. You tell me that you're reading it at the reading this afternoon. So I say, oh, I have to go to Plan B. But the Mottram poem got my attention because it made me realize beyond Robert Kelly, who is your teacher as an undergraduate, you had Eric Mottram as a teacher when you were a graduate student, and that idea, and you were my teacher. So it's always amazing to have teachers who have had great teachers. And this is something I hadn't really spent a lot of time thinking about, how much depth you get when your teachers had good teachers. And, you know, at a university level, you know, usually you're not aware of your professor's background. You're 19 years old. You don't really know much about your professor. You don't care. But for you, I mean, these are really important influences. You kind of seem to have absorbed through Kelly and through Mottram a very erudite, deep, historic thing that you've managed to pass along to us. I feel like that, I should have mentioned this is, CD is from Tawil Publications. And even that concept of Tawil, that came, I'd never heard of it before. And then Pierre Joris is my professor, and all of a sudden I'm learning about Tawil and, you know, Henri Corbin. And
right. To me, this was so such a strange and complex and nearly paradoxical situation, because coming to America, as I said earlier, because of the Beats to a great extent and the American space, the poets that I discovered from Kelly on, who opened up the whole Black Mountain people, because that is kind of that filiation, you know. And all of a sudden, I was with these poets who were totally interested in old European matters that I knew nothing about, your cult tradition, all of those things. But it was fascinating, you know, that coming here, I found another view, another angle, other ways into which that material I had run away from was actually handled, or could be handled, or could be worth thinking about and thinking through. And when I was in London working with Mottram, who was also, I mean, I had one course, one semester with him, but he was a lifelong friend. Eric was the first specialist in Europe of American literature. He was the first one to teach a thing called officially American literature at the University of London. So his view of American arts was very important to me. But I've always kept that, I love that mixture, the doubleness. The nomadic is also the angle from which we learn something, so that you get out of what would be your most simple way of being inside something, because you are inside of it, you know, so to step out and look at it from another angle. Mm-hmm. I then went to North Africa, I lived in North Africa for some years, and looked at both Europe and America from, you know, that totally different angle again.
You got to keep moving. I mean, that's kind of the message of Roots Not Roots too. I mean, it's
absolutely
a big theme of yours. So you spent then what, like 20 years teaching yourself at Albany?
Yeah.
And now no longer. So you miss it? Is there anything you miss about the academy at all?
Well, of course, you know, I miss good students like you. But I feel that the humanities have gone down in the last 34, you know, years. That it is very difficult in the university at this point to be in the humanities. It would be very irritating. It was even irritating in the last years. But be that as it may, you know, I don't regret having done it. But I'm very happy at this point where it's no longer teaching, but it is more, I'm still in front of a crowd performing, right, doing readings. And with my wife, Nicole Perrafitte, who is a performance artist, our collaboration you know, which we call a domo poetics, is something that both teaches us and maybe, you know, teaches others. We have both taught that at Naropa, and we go around. We just got back from New Orleans where we did a performance from Austin.
I saw that. I saw the, some of the footage on that. And she is an extraordinary performer, very, very intense. So you're saying you're still... if teaching is a stage, you're still kind of on stage in certain ways.
Yes, absolutely. Right. I mean, I don't want to. I don't want to lock myself up in some poet garret, you know, and write my last poems and you know, hope somebody will resurrect him somewhere. No, I'd like to take him out to, you know.
Can you believe that we're sitting here, I've been talking, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes or something, and I have not mentioned Paul Celan?
Good, why not?
I figure you're probably sick of questions about Paul Celan.
Well, let me go back to Nicole, who, when I say that indeed, by this October, I will have handed in the last book to be published next year because it's the centenary of Paul Celan. Mm. Nicole would say, ah, that Ménage à Trois will finally be over, you know, because she has had to live with me translating Celan for the 30 years that we have been together. But then I tell her, yeah, but remember that I lived 20 years longer with Celan. I started translating Celan here when I was an undergraduate at Bard in 68.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I didn't realize this until I was looking at your Wikipedia page that you actually... got a degree in translation studies.
Well, right? Not here. That was my MA, which I did with Ted Berrigan at the University of Essex in England.
That was amazing. I knew you knew Ted, but I did not know that he was actually. So, in addition to your own like 20 plus books of poetry and prose, how many books of Celan was it?
Well, I've translated everything now, so that's 9 books of poems. A book of prose, a book of essays.
Well, that is like living with someone else. It's got to be.
Right. No, it is.
All right. Well.
But, you know, Celan is the reason I came to poetry. At 15 in high school, German class, German teacher brings in somebody to read current poetry to us. We're all bored, you know, waiting, want to go out, play soccer or whatever. The man reads... Oh, yeah, that's okay. And then he reads the Todesfuge, Celan. And I have literally the hair on my nape standing up. And I know something is happening. And it's that maybe the only kind of, you know, what would you call it, a spiritual event that happened to me, in the sense I knew all of a sudden here was something that was not literature, that was not poetry as we have talking, but that was the use of language that was so strong that it changed the world in a way. And it changed me. And that's when I decided to turn to poetry and become poetry. So I'm paying off an unpayable debt.
I get it. I mean, I think if you become a lifer in the world of poetry, there has to have been something. I mean, you could ask probably just about any of us what that moment was, a eureka kind of discovery moment. You're finished with Celan, and you're not teaching. You're writing. You told me earlier you have another CD you want to make. I mean, what does the future hold?
Well, there's, you know, it's always multifarious. There are the poems simply that I write, that I get up and I write something. You know, some days I don't. Some days I write more. There is a lot of performance work that Nicole and I want to do, and we're working on a big performance that connects, if you want, Europe and not necessarily America, but right now Europe and Brooklyn, where we live, and which is goes back to cave drawings, to prehistoric caves.
There's something of hands.
The hands of Gargas and so on, yes. So that is a longish thing. We started it on the 1st of January last year at St. Mark's. We did a little 5-minute performance. We did a 20-minute version of it in New Orleans, and we are going to do an hour-long performance later, either at the end of this year, early next year in Luxembourg, weirdly enough, where we are invited again because of Nicole. There's a good gallery there. So that is one of the layers of work. I'm working on Jory's Reader. That is, I don't want to do a selected poems at this point. It seems silly. But I'd like to do a book that connects the poetry, the essays, and the translations, you know, and create a collage, you know, which I think is more representative, is the work that I certainly did. So there's that, and there's
great
a range
idea.
Of new ideas of other work to do.
Probably lots more cormorant poems to write, too.
No, I think I got to stop with the cormorant sometime, although as every time I walk along the narrows in front of my house, there are cormorants. There was two cormorants the day before yesterday. I went down, and there they were. And, of course, they will give me one line or two, and, you know, they will accumulate into some poems again.
Well, I remember that your interest in the cave paintings. You've done some poems previous to this one, right? Because when we were in the cave mm-hmm. in Rosendale, you gave a reading at the right. Subterranean Festival. There was a beautiful poem you read.
That poem is certainly a part of the performance work we're doing now. Mm. And Nicole is from the Pyrenees and very close to the Gargasse Cave. So we have been going to the Gargasse Cave on a number of occasions. There are the hands, and important for Nicole and her work also, it has one of the most beautiful female representations that is not shown to people, right? Because but that given that we know the people there, we were shown, Nicole knew about it and, you know, wanted to show it. It's a gorgeous vulva in stone. Wow. That the prehistoric people painted. They took a little stick of iron ore, and they put it into the vulva shaped on top, so it acts like it is like a clitoris, and the water that keeps coming down makes that ore red, and so there is this vulva that has been red and moist for the last 29,000 years.
Oh, beautiful image. You know, this is Poet Radio. My guest today on the show is Pierre Joris. And without further ado, Pierre Joris reading at Bard College, May 25th, 2019.
So I first would like to thank Robert and Charlotte for setting this up. Jane Brian, who was enthusiastic about it, and so this is why it is happening. I want to thank all the old 69ers who are here. Thank you. Welcome, guys. And everybody at Bard to put together this amazing weekend event. Now, I came here 52 years ago because as a foolish 18-year-old, I decided to be a poet and that I wanted to be a poet in the American language. Not the British UK stuff that my high school teacher was trying to instill in me. And the problem was, of course, that English was my fourth language. But at 18, you're foolish. And so I went to Paris, dropped out of medical school, and eventually applied via two expat students to this place. The first poem I'll read was pre-Bard, but it is a poem that I sent with my application. From me to no one. Who cares about shivering cigarette butts in the gutter? But the sea and triple tricky trick, sleeping with sunshades on loose floor, using Mao's poems as a pillow without nightmares, but coughing inhaled petroleum smoke into Tatum's piano, freezing its steel chords. God is an alarm clock, acid high, mountain deep. I don't know about carpenters or life in the desert. They say some cacti are drinkable, but Woody the Woodpecker doesn't agree. And anyway, Donald Duck blew his head off. That's how I got to Bard, believe it or not. At Bard, the biggest work I undertook early on was, well, let's put this still. I went to meet Robert because he was the poet at Bard, and I told him my dilemma about learning, becoming an American poet. And he said, he didn't ask me to take a class with him. He said, listen to baseball on the radio. That is the best American talk you can get and from which you can learn. I hope I did learn a bit about it that way. What it did was much worse. It made me fall in love with the Mets. And that's a 50-year cross I've had to carry. But they won the last four games. They were marvelous. While I was here, strangely enough, I had brought with me Paul Celan. And for my senior project, I proposed to translate Breathtone, as Robert said, and spent a semester and a half happily doing this and every week having Robert's comments on it. Let me read you one poem from Breathtone in my translation from those years. No sand art anymore, no sand book, no masters, nothing in the dice. How many mutes? 7-10. Your question, your answer, your chant, what does it know? Deep in snow, ipino, e-e-o. I moved to London in 72 because New York was kind of overdosing on post-psychedelic dope. And so I, which was a great place to sit around and think through all that I had learned and heard here for a while. And I wrote a book, I think it was the third collection I put together. It was called Hearthwork and was actually dedicated to Robert. Sorry, you're gonna get some dedications today, Robert, that's the way it is. Place of seed and syllables, they are what it is all about. Swarming all about the multitude of morning embers, fire particles, the swarm, the warm animals dancing, circling the flames. Warm-blooded, thus this round and dance. How to stomp, how to work fire from earth, fathaks and fire, incunabula nel mezzo mi retrovai. The way is the voice, not sotto, middle, ear, the intermediate place, mezzanine, still center, heaped earth matters, where the hair is parted, now ends sing. Singed for mismanaging the fire, we pass through, again and again, thoth, listening with the heart. Hearthwork is heap, heat, the slag of the daily life, the cinders needed to cradle of tomorrow's fire, the small eternal matter, the measure flares up. I was not through, however, with anguish about languages. Here's a poem called Anguish, a Riddle. That all the languages are borrowed, but how then do I count them that do not belong to me? In the first, I think. In the second, I sink. The third is my rhetoric, and the fourth, my west and wagon, its wheel at least traces these steps in harmonies of tetradic modalities. Before and after I sink. More assured were the little love poems of the time. So on this page, there is one. Love song. To language this love. Sparks flying off the intertwined tongues. Sparks turn to larks. Laughter, love. So there was always languages, tongues, and tongue means language, fork tongues or intertwined tongues, but tongues. Another poem of that kind of talk about my confusions in languages comes from the volume called Poesis. And it was really a poem I dedicated to Eric Mottram, my friend, teacher and friend in England. My mouth knows a language my hand and eye cannot imitate. The mother tongue there only as phony, though this sound rhyme be phony etymology, the fake, the counterfeit arising from old Irish Gaelic fawny, in which a small counterfeit deer hides. A gilt brass ring used by swindlers. The book does not tell me how to use a phony, not if it was a nose ring as for cattle, or a marriage ring, a token of exchange, a useless ring except for the purported value of its metal and counterfeit in that. So the real root of phony, sound, voice, is Indo-European ba, 3, which gives a list: fable, fate, infant, preface, prophet, abandon, banish, bandit, fame, phono, symphony, confess, and, not and, but blame. End of list. And while on American Classics, gravely Joe Cotton tells the girl with the glycerin tears, "I was a lot of things, a gambler, a thief, a phony." Another list, while here the search goes on, the phony origins downloaded days later, searching a CIA database, gathered intelligence for Luxembourg, and got this re-ethnic divisions. Quote, "Celtic base with French and German blend, like rich coffee, except whiter, and the language other." As Robert said, I moved around a lot, and I went and spent 3 years teaching in Algeria. I'll read one slightly longish narrative from those Algeria days. It is a poem called "The Horses of Lala Fatima." One, meditation in a kitchen. Out here, wherein the roads fork, we do too. The roads we go down, necessities passe-montagne pull tight over the eyes. To see through and choose, weird boast, like poking one's eye out, meaning in. Confusion of movement. You can have it if you want it both ways. I eat with a fork. I risked the road yesterday, we'll risk it tomorrow, tonight. We rest in the oasis of this kitchen, a needed rest. Nothing ever is acquired, proud boast, forgot about biology, irreversible processes, shorter breath as the lines are, get the lives. Heart colds in a canoon, movement at and of rest. Love prepares a feast, lamb roast in the oven, a tale to be told, to behold on the air. The time it takes the meat to take. Let's make use of the time we have carefully, accurately. The hours you spend oiling, washing, drying your hair, your patience, your accurate sense of your body against my impatience, my rotting teeth no longer all that long, the length now of my lines, the enormous ambition whittled down to the voice of the lyric, Box Canyon song. Where the horses rear, narrow ears pricked, nostrils flared, towards where the puma prowls, circling the meat in the oven, the time it takes. The way those muscles we call the mouse, la souris, musculus, and mousse, a cooked etymology, as in to cook the books, tighten under heat, then crisp and shrink back down the bone, white splinter glimmer, grows a handle on our lives of bone and words, and yes, we make what we make as bony as our lives. It turns and stops, and yes, control means loss. It does. Choice does, and yet is the only choice we have. Turn to roast, touch bare rocks, eternal snows, and in passing, touch and rest at the crossroads where we cross our eyes to Hermes. Touch to go on from, the feel of the land, your thigh's gentle slope. There is strength left in the bones and right there in your hands. It is all we need it all. Two, the tail crosses the road. Last rays, long days, the talk not of hope, more practical, or as they say, who's they, down to earth. Who dare talk down to earth? Under the surface, not the earth is ours, or under our talk's fastidiousness, we are just that and more. Anchored here in smell of roast, in your hands accurate mobility. Now this story happens when the prophet's only daughter, the mother of Hassan and Hussein, she who is called Lala Fatima, sends a caravan of horses from Mecca to Medina. Maybe it was from Medina to Mecca. We don't know when it happened. Was it before or after Muhammad's death? Before or after her sons were born? It does not matter. This matters. The horses lost their way. Or the drivers did. Again, the story doesn't tell. It was a human, not a horse, committed it to memory. And when the sun had set and their allotted time was up and they had not returned, how the parentheses flourish, how the processional stalks from every direction at once, while this art demands again and again choice at the crossroads, which is how I got this story. I talked of crossroads. You thought of the story of the horses of Lala Fatima as answer to my exegesis on the fork, not the one turned to roast, the one in the road where those eyes were offered to Hermes. Close parenthesis, open to where Fatima in long flowing gandura, anxious on rooftop, looks out over the battlements of Mecca or Medina, a tall house, her father, a rich merchant prophet, towards Medina or Mecca, where the straight road has been forked by the will of the horses, and Fatima now fetches a fat-bellied pot with a narrow opening she holds over the canoe, wherein burn the seven consecrated perfumes, black and white frankincense, alemi resin, wood of aloes, coriander, amber, and myrrh. Into the cleansed vessel a handmaiden pours spring water, and now both women, with the gathered tips of their fingers, raise the pot, and Lala recites a poem, a prayer, and lo, the pot turns. It does. A sure way, you say, a sign points out the direction wherein something has been lost. Let's use, you say, one of ours that way. I wondered what we had lost. Was coy, said, it is the earth turns, and our pot may be from the right place, but it's not in the right place. And who am I to attempt practical magic when I have such a hard time with the simple telling of the story, which is my job? And then you remembered more, remembered the mouthed words, which you say are the story you told me. And I went with the fork of the Greek road, where myth is the mouthed words, make or do they make the pot turn? I wanted more, felt something here I didn't grasp, pushed you, and you called your mother, who said there were no horses, there were camels, but they did get lost. And so the question returns as, where are the camels of Lala Fatima? Or should I change the title, rewrite the story? No, this is the story of the horses of Lala Fatima, the horses that didn't come back at day's end, or did as the pot turned, or came back as camels. The pot could not foresee that fork in the narrative road. Down one prong the horses rushed, up the other came the camels. Fatima is surprised. She has waited all these years. The pot in hand shatters. The prophecy come true. The horses are back as camels. We are none the wiser. Ceylon, my work will be done this year. Nicole says magnificently, finally, that ménage à trois is over. I tell her, watch out, I live 20 years longer with Ceylon than with you. It's only 30 years for us. Here is one of the last ones I translated. The translations are all done. I'm still working on some commentaries and preparing the manuscript. Tenebrae, we are near, Lord, near and graspable. Grasped already, Lord, clawed into each other, as if each of our bodies was your body, Lord. Pray, Lord, pray to us. We are near. Wind bent, we went there. We went there to bend down over crater and mar. To the trough we went, Lord. It was blood. It was what you spilled, Lord. It shone. It cast your image into our eyes, Lord. Eyes and mouth gape, so open and empty, Lord. We have drunk, Lord, the blood and the image that was in the blood, Lord. Pray, Lord, we are near. I returned to America, of course. Here's a poem on that return, 12/23/87, Annandale. Day breaks over Annandale as I wake to a wayward finch in Robert's house. Me in the house, not a finch. Having in the space of 24 hours gone from Luxembourg up to Keflavik and from Keflavik all the way down to New York City by DC-8 and curve of Earth and thence by trusty 76 Saab 99GL all the way up from JFK via Whitson Bridge, Interstate 678, then 684, west on 84, up the Taconic, down to 96 and over to Annandale on 9 West. Oh, our endless fascination with numbers as if something more than they themselves could be wrung from them. Oh, Paul, to be fettered with wine and soup, to be permitted to sleep in America, and to wake now in one-sided tête-à-tête discourse with this upstate finch. Color dreams of neurospace at hyperspeed, blue and red, silver and gold, pressure on ears and sinuses, sleeping furiously fast, the mere 4 hours. Morning coffee followed, as ever. Sun strikes yellow house across frosted road, the pump that doesn't work, the post office that was there once. The hotel will reopen at no date given under new. I hear my ears scream, birds feed, fridge hum. And a bit later, but what is Heidegger's hypocaimenon? Quelque chose, quelque substance ou substrat, Seelensubstanz. What could a curriculum for the soul be when we do not know what a soul be? A shot in the dark. A soul is a shot in the dark. One little poem from the volume Barzac. This afternoon, Dante will be expelled from Florence. A good thing, as how could he have written so well on the faraway imaginary exile of the comically divine realms had he not known what it meant to walk over a cold January day's ground frost, clod breaking, heart beating, from one city to another, to come to this, that exile is but the next step you take, the unknown there where your foot comes down next, in heaven or on earth. Exile is when you can still lift a foot. Exile is when you're not yet dead. Okay. Exile is always there. This title of this book is Hajara, which means Hajar in Arabic and basically means exile. Also means Hagar, the woman sent out in the desert, one of Robert's great poems. The dream of the desert in the book. One, the book lies open in all the hallways, in all the oases, in all the dreams, around every corner, behind every sand dune. In this dream, too, you have to add a line. Your place is between the already written and the unwritten, in the white empty space. In this dream, Stalin smiled and Heidegger, too. In this dream, cockroaches scuttled from the book, but it had to be written in, despite the smiles. A dream of a book. A dream of a desert in a book, a dream of a desert that runs from the book, a dream of a book and a desert, a dream of sand through fingers, a dream of white, a dream of mica, a dream of phoenix, a dream of a desert spilling from the book into and through the hallway and out the door. And the voice said, write in the book and you will be healed. A voice said, my middle, my voice, my will, write in the book, write the desert, the dream, write the sand, the white, write the running dream, the book. Two, a dream of Stalin, a dream of Ceylon, a dream of parents, a dream of houses. In the first house, Ceylon hides in a closet and Stalin bangs his big boots and storms over the wooden floor. In the second house, Ceylon escapes through the back window and Stalin screams and tears at his mustaches. In the third house, we are not. It is full to overflowing with all the parents, everybody's parents, Ceylon's and Stalin's and mine too. In the fourth house, there is a city in ruins. A moon stands above it. It is white. It is full. It has jebels and wadis on it. It is pouring with sand. Let me check the time here. Okay, I'll close with a couple quicker, shorter ones. Poem for cormorants. You mentioned cormorants, right? Quick cormorant poem here. Two for the cormorants. One, the heart of the cormorant is at the head of its name. It wants more, but no rand. Two, we applaud the cormorant, even if the fish slipping down its gullet won't. A postcard from France for Charlotte Mandel. Greetings and much love from Bayeux and its 7 meters long tapestry, actually an embroidery, the epicity of which is not really the story told, i.e. boys will be boys on the canvas, but the thing itself, the stitched canvas, the epic work of women making this enormously elegant object still there, i.e. there a millennium later. The boys fight. The women stitch it all back together again. Maybe it was. Penelope wrote the Odyssey. And final poem here. Back to Robert. Dear Robert, I wake up in pre-dawn Brooklyn, make water, heat water, squeeze lemon, crush homegrown at Joseph's on 68th between 3rd and Ridge, peppers, cayenne, make first pot of coffee, Peruvian organic medium roast, in orange French press thermos. Look out, windy, rain while we slept, heavy colored dreams we tell us we had, but don't remember more of. take her hot lemon and coffee to Nicole, finishing past Sunday's New York Times in bed, take my cups to my study, remembering last night's sweet Mets win in Washington, but really listening as I have since I got up to France Culture, where Olivio Cadio, speaking of his new Shakespeare translation, playing right now in a mise-en-scène by Thomas Ostermeyer at the Comédie Française, says, "Il n'y a pas de vers français pour accueillir le vers shakespearien aujourd'hui," which I totally agree with. As I put cups on desk, pour first coffee, turn to look out at white-capped waves, nothing Melvillian, just normal fall adjustment. Can't yet see the anchor chips. The leaves are still on the trees in the Narrows Botanical Garden across Shore Road. Wind tires or tortures them, or tries to. At least shakes them without sparing them so a big white incongruous light shines through every so often all the way from Staten Island. While all the way from wherever I was in my sleep to this moment of opening the red notebook and unscrewing the black sailor fountain pen, I have really thought of nothing else than that this day is your birthday, Robert. Many happy returns. Joyeux anniversaire. Alles Gute. Before I turn, in a moment right after sending this off to you, to the last three poems from Celan's Niemandrose, that remain to be translated, so that on this your birthday I may finish what I started in Annandale 51 years ago under your guidance. I raise my by now second cup of Peruvian to you, dear friend. Bay Ridge, also known as Sorrentino Stan, also known as Brooklyn. Thank you.
Have you ever wondered about radio for open ears? My name's Eugene Chadbourne, and my ears are open. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson. Thanks a lot.